welcome you to this session. Today we're going to hear about the overland journey from Utah to California, wagon truck from the City of Saints to the City of Angels. And our presenter today is Leland Lyman, and his most recent book is called The Overland Journey from Utah to California, Wagon Travel from the City of Angels to, the City of Saints to the City of Angels. And there are copies available for purchase if you would like to purchase a copy. And he will, the respondent for the session will be Russ Branson, who we all know and love as the director of the Miller Eccles Group. So if you enjoy Sunstone Symposiums, you can come once a month to Russ's house and hear equally stimulating conversations and speakers. So we'll turn the time over to Leo.
Thank you. Glad to be here. I've been playing with this trail for, I guess, almost 40 years. I served my mission in Southern California, being a Utah boy, but I didn't consider seriously pursuing a teaching career up there. And so in the preface of this book, I say I know that trail. I've been over it 270 times over the years. And many times there have been sidetracks looking for points of interest. And I've become something of a rut nut, meaning looking for the wagon road. And when they had a wagon reenactment about 4 years ago, they railroaded me into writing a little guidebook that I told the arduous road, the most difficult wagon road in American history. And nobody's ever challenged me on that. When you think about the road from here to Vegas, think about where you're going to get a drink of water. How are you going to water your livestock? And it's just as dry from there to the muddy river going the other way. In fact, about 400 miles with 10 water holes, if you can imagine, 40 miles apart. There's a Jewish Portuguese author, diarist, named Solomon Carvalho, who said that Providence made the trail possible by putting water in some rather unlikely spots. They're called Amargosa River, which means called bitter springs and salt springs, but it's possible. Thousands of animals died, no humans died, because of lack of water. Now, it had been a pack mule trail, the old Spanish trail, from Los Angeles to Santa Fe, since about 1827. So a 20-year career as a pack mule trail, and some of those pack mules were a mile, the trains were a mile long. And that's an interest point for me at this point. I'm actually running for national president of the old Spanish Trail Association. The Congress has just recognized that as a historic trail, and I want to try and promote that in the future. And there are many people in that organization who don't want anything to do with wagon routes. They're purists, and they're very hesitant. If I get defeated in this election, it'll be because they're afraid I'll bring the bastard stepchild wagon route into their scheme of reference. It started to be a wagon road with more Italian personnel who were at Chino, Rancho del Chino, not too far from here, worked for Colonel Isaac Williams, and he offered to sell the ranch. His wife had died, he was discouraged. And the Mormons, led by Captain Jefferson Hunt, knew they didn't have authority. This is 1848, a year after the Mormon pioneers have arrived in Utah, and Brigham Young's gone back to winter quarters, and the High Council, including Charles C. Rich, are in charge. And Hunt reported to them, and acting on his suggestion that they needed supplies from California, a company was organized of 18 men led by guys named Lathrop and Fuller, although Hunt is in the expedition along with several of his sons. They miscalculated how much food would need to travel over this so-called southern route. And what if Hunt's young sons, who will later be very prominent in Arizona history and politics, says that no other group of Mormon immigrants ever had to eat horse meat to get to where they were going instead of starving. When these and many other immigrants following that trail in the next year, because the gold rush is going to start in 1849, follow this southern route, Isaac Williams sends out a lot of supply wagons to help rescue them up in my home area on the Mojave River in Victorville. And there will be a half a dozen of those rescue missions. The first Hunt group that came to California in 1848 was obviously exhausted, and they were taken care of. They were given wild cows, which is no fun to milk, but it's better than not having anything but beef to eat. And then after rainy season that year, 48, they started back, driving 200 cows and some bulls, along with some other supplies. And they may have even started with a wagon, but they didn't make it all the way with that wagon. So I say it's a semi-successful party. They got back to Salt Lake in May 1848. But there was another group of Mormon battalion guys who had re-enlisted for 6 months. They were the single men, didn't have families to reunite with. And they too gathered at Chino just after the other group had left, gathering their, they don't use the word fit outfit, they use fit out in those days. And they're going to be heading over the southern route, which I apologize for not having a map. My lawyer friend has already told me. But most of you know I-15. And you know Cajon Pass. And you know that it stretches to Las Vegas. And then from Las Vegas to the St. George area. They didn't follow the Virgin Narrows, where the highway goes now. They went over Utah Mountain. And actually, there wasn't a St. George till 1860 or so. But there was a Mountain Meadows, which was an awfully good place to rest and recoup your animals before heading on down toward Cedar City and Parowan, and then on up the chain of settlements where I-15 follows now. One of these guys that came in the first group but stayed for the second is Porter Rockwell, and he'll lead the second group of Mormon battalion guys back. He's not much of a diarist. There's a great diarist in the group, but he doesn't keep a diary on this trip, and there are very few details other than that they took the first wagon over this western half of the old Spanish Trail. The title of my book was going to be From City of Saints to City of the Angels. University of Nevada Press changed the title. It's just a distant subtitle now, but the first wagon over that route was LDS, the second group of returning Mormon battalion guys in the spring of 1848. And one of the little tidbits that's never been discussed before is these guys encountering where a pack mule train had been massacred by Indians, probably earlier in 48. Throats slit by stone knives, which would be a little gory. These Mormon battalion guys buried them and barely took notice of this death of who knows how many, undoubtedly Hispanic packers, on back with them. Now, it was that year that gold was discovered in California, and when President Polk announced that in his State of the Union message, that will really start the gold rush. There have been people, including Mormon battalion guys, already in California who are in the gold fields, and it's amazing how significant the church members were in that first 2 years of the gold rush. The flood of American immigrants by three routes, but the main one will be by the Platte River through Nevada, by the Humboldt River, and over the Sierra Nevada Mountains. The problem with that is anybody that doesn't reach the Intermountain Great Basin by July stands the risk of meeting the fate of the Donner Party in 1846, getting snowed in the Sierras and not getting through, and for that reason, many who get to the Great Basin late in the summer decide to stop, not to live with the Mormons all winter, but to rest and recoup their livestock at Utah Lake mainly, the meadows near Payson mainly, and then take the southern route, which is an all-year, supposedly. I wouldn't try it in August, but an all-year route, you won't have too much danger with snowdrifts, at least. Over 100 wagons waiting at Utah Lake hear that Jefferson Hunt has been over that route, as well as over the northern route, and that he is a good leader. And he's apparently got some Masonic ties, and so some of these people trust him for that reason, and they engage him for $10 a wagon to lead 107 wagons over that southern route. Now, there's another group that left just before who supposedly couldn't afford the $10 a wagon, but some of them had been in the mob driving Mormons out of Nauvoo, and there may have been another reason they didn't join with a guy that was pretty fanatical against anti-Mormons and quite an advocate of retaliation whenever the time came. Anyway, in Hunt's group, there are a lot of preachers. And that's significant because the main point about this group is that Parowan or just beyond near Cedar City, it disbands and many of them decide to take a shortcut and will name Death Valley that year. These are people who have broken away from Jefferson Hunt, and I believe for the first time in the book explain quite logically why they split from Hunt. For one thing, 107 wagons in a train will move quite slowly, especially since there's only been one wagon train over the route, and it may not have always followed the most optimum route. So some days are cutting down riverbanks, Sevier River, between Nephi and Scipio, Utah, and that takes 2 days. And then there's a kind of a trial that they hold for an offense that's been committed earlier. The other unique thing about these companies is that they elect a captain, they elect sub-captains. In fact, there are 7 subdivisions, some of them famous in Death Valley history, like the San Joaquin that becomes the Sand Walking, and the Bug Smashers, and there are several, the Jayhawkers. These are subdivisions. And in the rules that they set up at Petite Neat, which is Payson, is one that says the 4 doctors with them can determine that it's sick to travel. The whole company stays there. And there are just as many preachers with them who want to keep the Sabbath, as does Jefferson Hunt, their main captain. So some who are really anxious to get to the gold fields are frustrated that they're going to have to stop every time there's somebody really sick or every Sabbath. And after taking 2 days at the Sevier Bridge, actually between Levan and Scipio on I-15, they get all the way to Holden where they camp, and that's a 30-mile waterless stretch. They do it because they know they're going to rest on Sunday, but there's a debate about whether they should keep the Sabbath or if they should get to the gold fields as fast as they can. And obviously, in the vote, the ones who want to move on lose. And in that, Jefferson Hunt made a stump speech where he stressed the need for absolute subordination to their leaders. He's one of my men in San Bernardino, and he should be honored because he's the first Mormon state legislator in California and the first representative of San Bernardino County, but he's a pompous son of a gun. And sometimes he doesn't know what he's... Well, he's a typical politician. Doesn't really have his ducks lined up as far as facts are concerned. He turned some people off in his advocacy of them following his leadership exactly and precisely. But probably the straw that broke the camel's back is when they get to Denver, which is a lush meadowlands with a river running through, they know that the next water is clear to Parowan, and that's a 40-mile dry stretch, and that's tough for any livestock that you're trying to maintain the strength of, because you know you're going to have waterless stretches later. He has the brilliant idea of following the Beaver River westward toward where Minersville will be in a while, and then making a straight shot toward Coal Creek, which is Cedar City, assuming that will be a shorter distance than from Beaver to Parowan, and he turns out to be wrong. But he's got these 107 wagons leaving the Beaver River near Minersville and heading over the low mountains between there and the valley where Enoch is, just north of Cedar City. And they're out there 13 miles from water, camped, waiting for him to get back, telling them which way to go to the creek. And he comes back thirsty, he can hardly talk. And some of them see he doesn't know where he's going for sure. But the leaders let him go out a second time. And after that, there is basically a mutiny. One of these sub-leaders named Cephas Arms of the Buckskin Division concluded, and he's not totally fair, our guide is off the direct route, and there's no disguising the fact that we're lost. They will have to go back all the way to Beaver and then go over the dry march to Parowan. And it's taken a week of time. But more than that, it's exhausted a lot of the strength of the livestock, and more than that, the patience of many of those guys that wanted to get to the gold fields as fast as they can. And about that time they got to the Parowan, Cedar City area, a group of packers on horses, some of them Mormon missionaries going to the gold fields, some of them with Parley P. Pratt heading for some of the mission areas of Chile and the South Pacific. And a guy with them has talked to a mountain man named Elijah Bart Ward, who has become a Mormon in Utah, and yet he's been with Joseph Redford Walker, a mountain man, and others who have made a direct march from the Great Basin north of Death Valley through Walker Pass, Isabella, Kern River, Bakersfield, the southernmost of the Sierra Passes, and a lot shorter distance to the gold field than coming all the way to Los Angeles and then turning north. And even though he doesn't have the precise map, this Reverend Smith says, hey, I believe we can find that. And 100 out of 107 wagons go with them over through the Enterprise, Utah area, into a really difficult headwaters of the Beaver Dam Wash, which is in Nevada, but the wash will drain down toward I-15 in the Arizona Strip, right next really to, well, there's a little retirement town now of Beaver Dam, and it's just before you get to the rapidly growing Mesquite area. Most of the Mormons and many, many of the others, after having a really difficult time getting wagons through these ravines and mountain passes, eventually see the mistake of their ways and retreat and try to find the old Spanish Trail southern route, including Hunt's footprints. The 7 wagons that stayed with him were all LDS. And Charles Hicks, the leader of the packers on horses, is one of the first to tell Reverend Smith, we're not going to continue this way. It's too dangerous. And they find their way back to the main route on Muddy River, where Glendale, Nevada is now, across the so-called Mormon Mesa from the Mesquite area. So they've missed the most difficult wagon pull up that mesa on the whole trail. But in the meantime, they've gone through some hell, including lack of water, and some of their colleagues who don't cooperate with each other at all are mentioned. One guy, a slave owner with a lot of money, says, "I'll pay any price for a drink of water," if you can imagine. And he gets no takers. And yet Charles C. Rich has a canteen, and one of the guys with him, Henry Bigler, who had been at Coloma when gold was discovered the year before, drinks all he wants. And Bigler's horse is breaking down. He and Rich take turns on Rich's horse. It's just amazing the cooperation of these Mormon packers compared to the every man for himself, let's get the gold rush as fast as we can. And they really don't have any sympathy for families that have to travel more slowly, or families that have less than seemingly the optimum amount of provisions. And the irony of this whole thing, in the details that I can't possibly cover here, but I've covered great detail in the book, is that many of those left behind end up saving the ones that went on and then came back to the main trail. Now, there'll be some go all the way through Death Valley and some that don't make it. Some that through heroism. When they get across the deserts on the edge of Death Valley, the ones that have come back to the main trail, which goes from Las Vegas to a place some of you know called Blue Diamond, Nevada, and then up a mountain into the Pahrump Valley, and then along the edge of Death Valley, a place called Resting Springs near Tecopa, which is Hot Springs Resorts, and then through the Canyon, past a very famous current recreational site, the Dumont Dunes. It looked like a city tonight out there with hundreds of campers. Then they're heading toward what is now a very busy Army base, Fort Irwin. And it's all desert, and it's a very difficult trip. And then you have to go across a pass, correctly named Impassable, except that they do it, and then down a pass called Spanish Canyon, and then you're only about 15 miles from the Mojave River, where it doesn't run on the surface, but where it's easy to dig a small pit and have the water seep in. And several of the Mormon packers, including a guy named James Brown, recorded in his diary when they reached the Mojave, he recalled, that "we felt as pleased as a man liberated from a life sentence in a dungeon. For we had reason to feel assured that we'd succeed in our journey." Bigler, whose diary is good enough to have been published, says such tramps and fatigues as they endured will make a man old before his days is half gone. Not too many people ever chose voluntarily to make a second trip, although the founder of San Bernardino, my great-great-grandfather, went over it 4 or 5 times, and I believe Charles C. Rich went over longer. Lyman wanted to come back and settle in San Bernardino after his mission to Europe. He told Brigham Young, "The journey's getting easier for me." I think I caught Grandpa in a fib on that one. He just wanted to be as far, frankly, from Brigham Young as he could be and still be in the church. There were 3,000 Mormons in San Bernardino. It was the biggest Anglo town in Southern California. It was the biggest Mormon town outside of Salt Lake Valley. And almost every one of them went over that southern route at some time, and many of them recorded their experience, and I have them in the book, but I'm not going to talk much about that immigration of LDS to and from San Bernardino. But some of the support with them, the mail carriers that go over that route every month, are most fascinating. They're going through Indian country. The Indians are not hostile particularly. They're open to a lot of... You mean I only got 5 more minutes? He's got 15. I've got 20. Are we? We're going to end at 4:11. 15 minutes for questions. We're not going to have quite 15 minutes for questions. We're going to have 10 minutes for questions and 15 for him. So I better get moving. All right. These males, there never was one killed, even though they're out in that wild country alone once a month. They feed and give tobacco to those Indians, and they really have promoted a good relationship. And that's something I pick up on in the next part, which is about the Southern Indian Mission established in 1854 at Harmony between Cedar City and St. George, led by John D. Lee. But the missionaries who come in there, who don't think you can have harmony in Harmony if John D. Lee is the leader, but they try, in spite of him, to get along and promote a relationship with those Indians. And it's amazing how far it goes. But I focus on their motive. The predominant theme in their first sacrament meeting, private among themselves, was discussing their callings to teach and befriend the Indians. And one of them, a guy named John Lott, mentions back in Hans Mill and in Missouri, the tarring and feathering of Joseph Smith. Several of them have had brothers and relatives killed at Hans Mill. One of these guys, David Lewis from Parowan, says he's alive to avenge his blood, the brothers, when the Lord will. And he also says, we'll teach these Indians to work. But what he means, and I'm not twisting this, Juanita Brooks edited that diary that this Southern Mission account's coming from, makes it clear the meaning is avenging the deaths of loved ones killed earlier in the Midwest. They're trying to get the Indians to give up their savage customs. One of the telling statements is Ephraim, and they should be saying Manasseh, was the battle axe of the Lord. They mean Indians. Battle axe of the Lord. And may we not have been sent to learn and know how to use this axe with skill. Michael Quinn has talked about a culture of violence. And I add to it a culture of revenge for past injustices to Mormons. And in a very real sense, I can prove that the alliance with the Southern Paiute Indians is for that purpose. And I believe that no one can say Brigham Young assigned them to that. I can find no evidence that that's in the assignment of these missionaries, although getting to know the Indians and empathize with them and learn their language is the most important point. Now, the closest large group of Indians to Harmony is down at Tokerville, named for Chief Toker. And his son, Terub, who's been baptized and ordained an elder by Lee, is sent over the trail to tell Native Americans that Mormons have come to do them good. And this missionary, as he's reporting, is quoted in this Thomas Brown diary, the Journal of the Southern Mission. All the Indians on the way, clear to San Bernardino, are very favorable to the Mormons, which name is a password for friendship among these mountains and Indians. That's exactly what the missions intended to do. As is the mission founded the next year at Las Vegas. Not the first settlement in Nevada, because Mormon Station is, but the Mormons settled Carson Valley and Las Vegas in this period of time. Probably they wanted a station midway on this long journey to San Bernardino, but there's nothing very official about that. If they just want to teach the Indians how to grow crops and not be hungry, they're better off in the Santa Clara area where the Indians already have farms, or on the Muddy River, the Moapa Valley, just actually where Lake Mead is now, which was a much more successful agricultural area. In fact, when the missionaries went through Santa Clara, the Indians chided them and says, if you want to do missionary work, stay with us. It's too hot in Las Vegas. There may be other reasons that wouldn't be a good location, but they went on to Las Vegas, and their leader is a guy named Bringhurst, and he selects a spot. There's a fort there replicated that's there now in almost the downtown area of Las Vegas. They're partly to try and prevent misunderstandings with immigrants and maybe even intercede on the side of the Indians some of the time for fair treatment. They're to set an example of sobriety and industry for the Lamanite brethren. Bringhurst chooses that spot, and it's got some farmland around it on the bench. And then down where the creek runs down the hill, there's more farmland, but saturatus, alkali, keeps the crops from growing. And these missionaries, several of them say, hey, our grain came up well with the help of Indian labor, but then it withered and died. Saleratus killed it. And several people in their diaries and in their letters say that. And it's most disheartening because in any mission, part of the promise of the missionaries is to help feed and clothe the people that they're teaching. And that may have been one of the greatest failings of this Las Vegas mission. And most of the time, Brigham Young would have sent support from outside. But almost nobody, even in the church, knows what a famine there was in 1855 and 54. This very time, there really aren't any surplus resources to send to the mission. And it's partly grasshoppers up in Utah and things like that. The missionaries are even hearing their own families are hungry. And the mission, the Indians are most dedicated to working. And the missionaries, like George Washington Bean, who speaks their language the best, says they didn't have sufficient provisions and grain to deal out to the Indians and put them to labor as many of them desired. Even President Bringhurst said, if he only had food to deal with them, he'd have 50 of them working at the present time. John Steele tells George A. Smith, one of the apostles, the grain won't hold out, it won't last till the next year, even for the missionaries, let alone feeding the Indians. And the Indians have the attitude that, hey, we deserve to be fed too. They're using our land, they're in our area, we've made treaties of agreement, but part of this agreement was that we be fed. And all of a sudden there'll be some thieving. And it's impossible to stop it. The missionaries preach to them about honesty, but hunger will do wonders for promoting dishonesty. And the Indians are saying, hey, these are our resources too. They're on our land. And it's a very, very difficult situation. Even the chiefs are condoning this, although they want a good relationship with the Mormons. Now, a year after this Las Vegas mission, they start looking for lead, knowing that they need some ammunition for coming conflicts. And it's not unexpected that the government's going to send an army. They really do know that is a distinct possibility. They find a lead mine, a place that's later a silver rush to Potosi, which is a South American name, but it's also a Nevada silver rush name. And the Mormons had an excellent mining operation there. The problem was some of the lead burned, and some said it was silver in the ore, some said it was silver in the ore. The first silver bullets for Lone Ranger before Condoleezza Rice were Mormon bullets mined at Potosi. The miners, especially a guy named Jones, do not get enough support from the Indian mission at Las Vegas and eventually go back to Salt Lake to get more supplies and to tattle to Brigham Young that Bringhurst is not supporting the mining. When Jones comes back with more equipment, he brings a letter from Brigham Young disfellowshipping the head of the mission, Bringhurst, for not cooperating with the miner, but Bringhurst's instructions from Brigham were not that clear. It's quite an unfair thing that Brigham has done, disfellowshipping the president of the mission and putting another guy in charge and telling the other guy, you've got to support these missionaries better, these mining missionaries better. By that time, the Indians are becoming disruptive. And Brigham writes directly to the Indians saying, hey, if you've got a problem with any of these missionaries, write to me. I'll send Dimmick Huntington, or I'll come myself. We'll resolve it. But the Indians are threatening by that time. And Brigham gives permission to close the mission, which in a sense is a kind of a cruel thing if you've promised the Indians you're going to feed them and then all of a sudden you pull out. But the head of the mission, a guy named Thompson, who was one of the original missionaries, and Brigham has appointed him in the place of Bringhurst, says most of these Indians understand that they've brought this on themselves as well as us. When my grandfather Lyman came through a year or so later and saw the ruins, he made a statement that a sad monument to the folly of poor, short-sighted, selfish men who sacrifice the interests of the kingdom and the people on the altar of special or personal selfishness. And he's talking about the miner Jones, but Brigham backing him a little bit too. When they closed the Las Vegas mission, there will never be a Mormon corridor, and there really never was. One of my old BYU professors, Eugene Campbell, as he was studying this, said that although there had been some earlier historians, including Milton R. Hunter, talk about it, it was executed in a haphazard manner and abandoned without the usual historic effort characterized by Mormon enterprise. And that's what I see as I write about San Bernardino. Brigham doesn't really like the town. He makes anti-San Bernardino statements every year. And when he gets a chance to close it, when Johnston's armies come to Utah, he will close it without batting an eye. And there never was such a corridor, even though they had talked about it when San Bernardino was first settled. Now with the gold rush, Gentiles will build a railroad across Panama. You can get from New York City to San Francisco in 5 weeks if you can catch the train across Panama and find a steamship to take you up the coast. And it's a lot cheaper than buying a covered wagon and going from winter quarters to Salt Lake City. And according to my best research, one out of every 17 people that took that route died. There are people that say, we never went a mile without passing graves. We never went very far without passing grave diggers. It was mostly cholera. There was no cholera on my route. Some of you know that the Willie Martin Handcart companies, more than 200 died in 1856. If they were using this other route, it would have been almost deathless. So there is some lapse of judgment or inspiration, perhaps, in that. And some of the church leaders who say, don't you dare blame me or you're going to hell, about the handcart companies, may deserve a little blame. Now, I agree. I've got about 3 minutes left, which means I can't really talk about Mountain Meadows except to summarize. There is an alliance with the Paiute Indians that one of those Las Vegas missionaries, John Steele, who's the head of the militia there, says, we can have 1,000 brave warriors on hand in a short time to help quell the eruption that might take place in the principalities if we keep this relationship going. And it does. It's a front alliance with the Mormonese against the Maricats. Now, Brigham Young's role has been discussed. I don't agree with Bringhurst on many things, but that interview in the president's office where the Indian interpreter, Huntington, says, you can have all the cattle in southern Utah. The Indians are hesitant. They say, you've never told us that before. I document in my book, Brigham Young Making Speeches, where he says, I'm not going to keep hold the Indians back anymore. And he certainly didn't. He gave them permission. He didn't know how many people were going to be killed. They're not going to give up their livestock without a fight. And everybody knows about the messenger sent to Salt Lake to find out what Brigham wants. And he brings a message back saying, leave the Indians alone. Let them do what they will, but you keep your friendship with them. When you put that with his previous instructions to the Indians, he doesn't look near as good in Mountain Meadows as he might otherwise. Another story is of the party that's already in southern Utah in Beaver when the massacre takes place, and they would have been massacred too had not Indian missionaries, especially Jacob Hamblin, interceded. They lost their cattle. They hated the Mormons because they'd paid them to protect them. They had no idea how close they came to being killed as well, but they were not. The missionaries were able to negotiate. We'll give you the cattle. More than half of it's mixed, Mormon and non-Mormon. It's not a Mormon trail. It's the southern route that Mormons were about half the patrons of, including when it's a wagon route. Let me just give you one significant statistic in closing. In 3 months, in 1859, 270 wagons went from L.A. to Salt Lake City. 270 wagons. That's a pretty heavily traveled road, even in 1859. Thank you very much. I hope there's time for you.
Well, thank you. I'd like to congratulate Leo on a fine and interesting paper. I have the entire paper. You didn't hear all of it. Leo also likes to embellish as it goes along, so some of my comments, you've answered some of them, and some raise additional questions for me. Yes, you did. He did tell me that. Leo undoubtedly knows more about the early overland route than any other living person. I think that's true. If you have an opportunity to invite Leo to speak to any of your study groups, please do so. I must compliment Leo on getting me his paper 2 weeks in advance. That is not something, in my experience, that happens in most academic conferences. So thank you, Leo. Now, Leo has recently published a very handsome book, The Overland Journey, from Utah to California, Wagon Travel from the City of the Saints to the City of the Angels. This volume was issued only a few weeks ago. Again, congratulations to Leo and University of Nevada Press for a very handsome volume. If you take a look at that, it is really nice. The dust jacket is handsomely designed. The pen and paper appear to be top quality. Text is printed in attractive font style, and it's got this easy on the eyes double columns per page. So I think you would enjoy this volume. I see a few of them right there. Pardon me?
It's small print.
Small print? Well, as you see, I have to use these. You know, for those of us our age, Leo, why it's small print. Okay. To truly appreciate Professor Lyman's paper, you need a very good map in mind. In order to understand Leo's paper, I turned to three useful maps in his book. So in the first chapter, you will see the maps in here. Most of you have driven from Los Angeles to Salt Lake City. Go ahead. Along Interstate 10 to Interstate 15, and then along Interstate 15 all the way to Salt Lake City. I would like to take you on a brief journey from Salt Lake City down from Salt Lake to Los Angeles. For the most part, I-15 travels on the southern route through Utah to Cedar City. And I expect that I-15 is actually on top of the old route in many places. One question I have for you is how many physical traces of the trail still remain? So perhaps in the question and answer, you can answer that question. From Cedar City to the Cajon Pass, I-15 and the southern route generally run parallel, occasionally crossing each other, but often as far as 20 to 40 miles removed. By examining the maps, I had many questions answered. For example, as you drive along I-15 through the desert at 75 miles an hour, you're probably traveling as far in 15 or 20 minutes as most immigrant trains could travel in a day, maybe even farther. It's hard to imagine how slow travel was on the trail. Nevertheless, the dry and barren landscape along I-15 from St. George to the Cajon Pass, except as a very few isolated spots that I can almost name on one hand, there was simply no water there. But the southern route, wagon road, meandered from side to side of the present-day I-15 to find the springs and streams that sustained life throughout the hostile country. Basically, from Cedar City to Cajon Pass, the southern route departed from the present-day I-15 by traveling west from Cedar City toward present-day Enterprise, then south to Mountain Meadows, to the Santa Clara River, west from Santa Clara into present-day Nevada, then south to the Virgin River near Mesquite, just below the Virgin River Gorge. Later, the freight route stayed a bit west of the Virgin River in the higher country, not dropping down into the Virgin River Valley in order to avoid the uphill climb out of the valley. I think I've got that right. From the Virgin River Mesquite, the southern route and I-15 generally follow each other quite closely to Las Vegas, then split again. I-15 heads south through the dry and barren country to Jean, Nevada. That's there where Whiskey Pete's and all those other new casinos are. It goes up through Mountain Pass, California, down to Baker and to Yermo, just north of Barstow. The southern route headed west from Las Vegas before turning more south. This route stayed in the hills and the mountains in order to find water. As far as terrain, the southern route was far more rugged than the present-day I-15, but that's where the water was. From Barstow to L.A., the southern route is generally within 5 to 6 miles of present-day I-15 and I-10. In fact, Leo, I assume the southern route probably came right through present-day Claremont, perhaps the southern end of the city?
Foothill Boulevard.
Oh, Foothill Boulevard, north of us here. Okay, that's old I-60, Route 66. Route 66. I have here a battered road atlas. I'm fascinated to look at the maps and try to get in my mind the mental picture of where I am in relationship to the geography of the southern route. On your next trip, if you're not driving, take along a map and follow your progress, noting all the geographic and topographic features on your way. Get off I-15 at Mesquite and follow the old southern route to Cedar City, and you will enjoy it. Now, let's take some water. Now onto the substance of Leo's paper. One danger of commenters and reviewers is that we comment on the paper or book we wish the author had written rather than on the one the author actually wrote. Along these lines, I will have a number of questions to ask Leo regarding unanswered issues. Now, if they're in your book, I haven't really studied books since it's new, and I just got it a week ago, so some of the answers might be in here. One of the major points I would like to have Leo address is the spreading of diseases by travelers on the trail and the impact on the Indians. Now, Leo, I think you told me on prior occasions that there might have been 15 or 20,000 Indians along the old Spanish trail. Might be too high. So when you say that one of the missionaries bragged he could have 1,000 Indians fighting, to me it seems very unrealistic because those maybe 10 to 15,000, 15 to 20, were scattered all the way from San Bernardino up through central Utah and then back down to New Mexico. So some of these diaries probably had some exaggeration in it that we need to be aware of. Who spread the diseases, Mormons or non-Mormons or both? What were the diseases? When time period did the diseases have the greatest impact on the Indians? Did the Indians perceive the whites as the source of disease? If so, how did that affect Indian attitudes toward the whites? So if you have a few chances, you know the answers, you might ask that. How many physical traces of the trail remain? Okay. Now, a few more comments. Before the wagon train started, you mentioned that from 1827 up through about 1848, there had been pack mules. So part of the question was, how well marked was the old Spanish trail? Could I, with a horse and plenty of water, actually have followed it without a guide? Or was this really almost uncharted wilderness for those who wanted to travel that, particularly the Latter-day Saints coming back from Gold Fields or from the Mormon Battalion. You mentioned that the fellow down in San Bernardino, Isaac Williams, in Chino, had sent a rescue mission for the Mormons who were coming down, had either horses at Las Vegas. How did he know about that? There was no telegraph or telephone or cell phones. Oh, they did. So they said, we're in trouble. Go down there and see if you can find some people to help us. Back then, it took almost 3 months on the trail from Los Angeles up to Salt Lake City. Once the wagon train started from Nebraska to Salt Lake City after the trails were blazed, it took, 6 to 8 weeks? So it was probably an actual shorter route from winter quarters into Salt Lake City in terms of time than it would take from Los Angeles up to Salt Lake City. Now, the reason I mention that is you indicate that perhaps Brigham Young and other Mormon leaders really made a mistake and should be blamed for not looking at the Southern route as an alternative. The railroad was completed in 1855 across the Isthmus, but the handcart companies really were planned in 1854, 1855, and then they started in 1856. So at that time, I think it was probably not realistic to assume that anyone could see the Southern route as an alternative. And even then, the physical terrain and lack of water, I think, presented a real barrier as a really practical immigrant route at that point in time. I think it would really take the railroad to make that a serious immigrant route. Now, your paper skips the 1849 period to the 1854 period. I'm not sure what was happening. Maybe it was just pack trains or freight trains back then. Okay, so in that 5-year period, you didn't chronicle your paper, perhaps in your book, made the southern trek down and settled in San Bernardino. Now, you mentioned in your paper, and also briefly, leading up to the Mountain Meadows tragedy, mass murder, you would say, is a proper word, what you call, by the way, a culture of revenge among the Saints in southern Utah. And Leo mentioned in a footnote in his paper that he remembers singing songs about this. I grew up in Centerfield down in Sanpete County. Now, for those of you who perhaps are from northern Utah, Utah ends at Payson, I think. Everything else is southern Utah. So I grew up in southern Utah. I don't remember really singing these songs. I remember about the blood of Illinois staining the escutcheon of the state of Illinois, but I don't remember revenge songs. There might have been that one, but otherwise, in the Southern Utah culture, I didn't even see any remnants or echoes of the culture of revenge or vengeance.
I never heard of Mountain Meadow, and I grew up 100 miles away from it.
So I really question about whether Mike Quinn or Will Bagley have really captured the essence of a culture of revenge. I don't see it. I have looked in the journals that are available on the CD-ROMs that we have. I just can't find anything along those lines. I can't find much about blood atonement. Very few references, and there was really a reference to the Old Testament, New Testament, nothing about this is what we do in Utah to murderers. I just don't see it. So I think that you perhaps quoted that culture of revenge, and I don't think there's proper support for it, and I think it really colors a lot of perception of what happens in Mountain Meadows, and it does not explain it very well. And even at that, you concede in your paper that Brigham Young and the church hierarchy really didn't preach this. If you go search the journal discourses and all of the public preaching in Salt Lake, you just don't see it there. Okay, now, the Indian relations were important because it affected the trail. You talked about the great efforts to cultivate friendship. We got to cut off here? Okay. No problem. The last point I had was simply this. Going back to the battle acts of the Lord, I mentioned it briefly. They bragged about 1,000 braves. That was not realistic. they pacified the Indians. They asked the Indians not to attack the Americans. They protected them. Even after Mountain Meadows, they went up and protected the next wagon train through. The other wagon trains going before the Thatcher Party got through safely. I think that the battle axe of the Lord also is perhaps very localized in this one sacrament. I'm not sure. I never grew up with that. I haven't seen it in the literature. So Mountain Meadows, in my view, still remains unexplained. I can't explain it. I don't think Will Bagley got it. I'm going to see what Ronald Walker's book would say. Still the most interesting and tragic aspect of the Mormon Overland Trail that, in my view, yet remains unexplained. So those are my comments. Any other comments for Leo? Leo, you might want to answer some of the questions I raised. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Just read Juanita Brooks's edition of Thomas Brown's Journal of Southern Mission, and it's very clear of the alliance. Whether there were 1,000 Indians or not, I have doubts too, but it's possible if you count all of the Southern Paiutes, that includes the Chemehuevis from the Colorado River, even to the Mojave River, all the way to Beaver, Utah. There definitely are the warriors, but I'm not going to argue that. Indian disease, measles, smallpox, syphilis, which the Mormons, I don't believe, passed on, although my ancestor was at the Eagles, among the Mojaves, and they offered their women to his people, and they turned them down, and they knew some of them had venereal disease from other Americans that had been there before. How much of the route's visible? The other book, The Arduous Road, has photographs. In Utah, especially in the Beaver area and down in the Cedar City area, I had a group of Cal State San Bernardino students out 2 weeks ago, my wife Brenda and I. We drove over 40 miles of the wagon road through Pahrump Valley and hiked over 20 miles of it through what's called California Valley, just as you come into California from the Pahrump area toward Tecopa. It's amazing how much of it can be seen. As far as the Pack Mule Trail, the next thing from the California Valley is called Emigrant Pass. I have a friend, Cliff Walker, who has spoken to Sunstone before. He calls pieces of trail artifacts in place. You can see a couple hundred yards of this Pack Mule Trail in Death Valley, where it doesn't rain very much, still visible after it hasn't been used for 150 years. Now let's open this up to... Okay. She's strict, but she's right. The room will be used. A question. She's scared of him into not answering. Ask him. No question? Yes, sir. Did one for a few individuals once, a couple years ago, the one that meets at his house in La Cañada, Woodbridge. I'm retiring in 3 weeks. I've got a lot of time to take people over the trail, especially Cajon Pass, and it's fascinating to see. Let me know, we'll figure something out. I've taken a lot of groups, different guys. Thank you.